Hello everyone and welcome to Sports Community Radio here on RPPFM, the voice of the peninsula. We're back, Joe Novella and Steve Pallisfera, season number two, bringing you all the best in grassroots sport. Welcome to the show, Steve Pallis.
G'day Joe, great to be back.
Fantastic to be back. We're on a new time slot. The guys at RPPFM have boosted us up the rankings here, and we're on at Friday night, 7 o'clock, which we enjoy. It's just after fish and chip time, and a lot of people coming home, Steve, so they'll be very interested in what we have to say about grassroots sport, in particular our first couple of segments, which is all around grants and the latest news in the world of grassroots sport.
Yeah, and then stay tuned after we do that, Joe, because fundraising ideas are often hard to come by, and,
oh, yeah.
and today we're going to introduce a company and a person who we have no link with that has got a way of for clubs to raise significant amounts of money and have a significant amount of fun at the same time, and maybe not have to work that hard, Joe.
Absolutely.
As you know, I'm inherently lazy. So, now let's get right along with it. So, there's some grants, and geez, Jason, over the last couple of weeks, as we're winding down, we're into the middle of November now, and I thought it was getting a bit quieter on the grant front, but then all of a sudden, geez, a big one's hit the table, and it's not from any government this time. It's called the Holden Home Ground Advantage Grant, and it's Holden Motor Car Company. Let me just move my computer this way, Joe. Supporting local sporting clubs for the next 10 years by committing $5 million to develop and improve their facilities. So twice a year, Holden will provide $250,000 worth of grants to sporting clubs who need them. That's $500,000 every year, Joe, for 10 years. So that's a pretty good investment in local sport, I reckon. So the program, it provides local sports clubs with the chance to invest in club rooms, sporting grounds, equipment, up to $250,000. Clubs are welcome to submit separate applications. And the first round shuts, I'm just going down, closing 28th of February 2015. So interesting part of this this process is that you can, not only the application, the traditional way of making an application, Joe, is to, you know, fill in a form, traditional, fill in a form, but not for this one. This one you're allowed to provide images to support your application as well as an accompanying video. So clubs get to really, really get to highlight their vision of what they're trying to do with their facilities. Now, don't think for a moment that, and again, we won't speak on behalf of Holden, but we are trying to get Holden on the show just to talk about this grant because it is quite a significant investment in community sport. But don't think that it has to be a professional video because they're not looking, and they state this in the application, they're not looking for professional videos. And you don't even have to have video as part of the application process. But jeepers, Joe, if you can have a video, just shoot it on the iPhone or your smartphone. Show them what you're trying to achieve. Sell them your vision. And most of all, tell them how this is going to help your community and your club. Fantastic initiative. So that's one grant. And there's another corporate grant that's open. This time in regional Western Australia, which is the McDonald's GWN7 Junior Sports Trust, which is for regional schools, junior sporting teams and sporting clubs, sporting associations in regional Western Australia, can apply for equipment equipment grants or participation grants up to $60,000 of grants each year will be given out to regional clubs in Western Australia. So really strongly, Joe, to encourage clubs to have a look at those two grants. ACT has also opened up a Health Innovation Fund grant, which again closes after Christmas, so there's plenty of time for clubs in Canberra to apply for the Health Promotion Grant. So even though we thought it was closing down a bit earlier on in the in November, Joe, there seems to be a lot of grants coming out and coming up for the holiday season. So lots of places that clubs can apply for grants. So that's good news.
Absolutely good news. And the reaction to the grant, especially the Holden Grassroots one on our social media, at our Facebook page and also on our Twitter, has been extraordinary, with an extraordinary amount of shares. Obviously, the engagement and the interest from our audience, sports community audience, has been incredible for that. So encourage you to get your applications in ASAP, because there is a lot of people interested in this particular grant, and why not? $500,000 for grassroots sport, sensational.
Up to 500 twice a year for Holden Grant. Yeah, now you spoke about our social media, Joe, and also the news. So let's combine those two. Some people would say we planned that segue, which those that know us will know that's nowhere near the truth. But our social media, the one topic, Joe, that's lit up our social media over the last couple of weeks is, I guess, women's role in sport and equality. And I guess from our perspective, it's about opportunity lost. But there's been two significant announcements during the week that within the world of sport relating to roles of ladies and women. And the first thought I wanted to just talk about was the NRL yesterday, and yesterday being the 17th of November, so we're midway through November, coming up to Christmas, Joe. So if you've got any ideas for Christmas presents that Joe and I can actually give our wives, please email us on jointheshow@sportscommunity.com.au. We will probably start to put this request out now every week until Christmas, and we may even have prizes towards the end, as we don't do anything about that until the last couple of days before Christmas. But the NRL has appointed their first lady into the role of chief operating officer. Now, Joe, in the NRL, the chief operating officer is effectively the 2IC. So the I'm just reading the press release as we speak. Suzanne Young has just been announced as the NRL's new chief operating officer. She has more than 20 years of management, strategy, development, operations in major companies across aviation, financial services, and technology. She has a passion and a commitment to sport as a participant, a volunteer, official, and administrator. New South Wales by birth, and she was she's got a very strong background in surf lifesaving, Joan. She was even the Australian Surf Lifesaver of the Year in 1996, and one of Surf Lifesaving Australia's first independent directors in 2010. So she and I was reading in the today's newspaper article, or the news around today, and I'm not sure which paper it was. Where they interviewed her and asked her about whether she was worried about the blokey culture. And she said that she's worked in many organisations where there is a perceived blokey culture, and she didn't see it as much of an issue, including organisations like Leighton's Construction. So and sports. So that's a tremendous step in a almost male dominated sport to appoint the 2IC into the role. And particularly, Joan, I know there's been a lot of commentary on social media today, and it's not about gender, but it's more about skill sets and the fact that Suzanne hasn't come from rugby league. She's come from outside rugby league. So it's interesting that rugby league have decided that their 2IC doesn't necessarily need to know about the game per se, which I'm sure she does, but it is more bringing those corporate skills to the role and to the sport. So that's a tremendous move, I think, from the NRL.
Absolutely.
Now, Aussie Rules has also, well, a club near and dear to my heart, Joe, is
that, oh my God, you're going to make this about Richmond, aren't you?
No, I'm not, Joe. I'm actually making it about male-dominated sports, including females. And I'm not talking about, I mean, we've always been very strong on this. It's not this for us, and for other people, it is a gender discussion. For us, it is not a gender discussion per se. It's a discussion about, you know, opportunity and the best people for the role. And we've got to create as many opportunities to create best people for the role. Now, I am going to talk about the Richmond Football Club because, Joe, as you may or may not be aware, the Richmond Football Club is one of the, I think, the only AFL or NRL or A-League football clubs to have a female president in Peggy O'Neill. And Richmond have committed, and this is really interesting, Richmond have committed to having 40% of females on its board by 2016 and a female quorum at the executive level. So that means that they're really serious about having females in the leadership role. And again, reading the article, and I'm reading, sorry, Joe, in fairness to the disclosure, this is an article that was published in today's Financial Review, and it's available on the Financial Review website, and it was an article written by...
And in Clearinghouse for Sport, which we love as well.
And in Clearinghouse for Sport, yeah. And it was an article written by John Stensholt. So great article by John, whereas he tells the story of Richmond looking to increase the number of women at the leadership role, at the leadership level. And reading between the lines of the discussion, it's not necessarily... a gender discussion per se, because when you delve deeper into it, and again, there's the title, John's used the heading in the article, Joe, blokey culture, and about 31% of current Richmond members are female compared to AFL-wide average of 34%. And the club wants to increase the number of females members to 50% in 10 years' time. So that makes tremendous sense just from a commercial perspective. So the club's general manager is John Coates, general manager of Richmond Football Club, the club's general manager of People and Culture, which is a lady named Amanda Green, said widening the pool of candidates for having females capable of working in football would be good for a business that operates in a competitive industry. It would help attract and also retain better staff, she said, and increase market access and brand and reputation. So one of the things that Richmond want to do is they want to develop a pool of women capable of working in the traditional male areas of the club, such as recruiting, coaching, and commercial operations, and as well as educate unconscious bias for staff, players, and sponsors. So the club's also formulating a version of the Male Champions of Change, which is more coming out of business. And so they're looking to have ambassadors to promote this change. So I think it's fair to say that Richmond Football Club has made a conscious decision to engage and embrace its entire supporter base, Joe, of which half the supporters, well, I think more than half the people in the whole community, Joe, are women. So it makes perfect sense for a club of any description to make sure that their membership, their participation, their players, their supporters, their sponsors are representative of the community that they represent. So I think it's a tremendous move in the leadership of sport. And Joe, just thinking about getting your thoughts on how community clubs can follow the lead. Do you think that community clubs should be setting some targets to have equal representation of men and women on their committees, and equal representation of men and women at the coaching level, or do you think that's going too far?
No, I think that's an absolutely fantastic target and objective to have. I mean, for a lot of people, they automatically assume when we bring up this discussion that there's an imbalance of women. And that's not always necessarily the case.
Netball.
Netball is a case in point where the opposite is actually the fact, which is there's an imbalance of male participation, and not only at the sport level, but in the administration of the sport as well. So, you know, when we talk about gender inequality, we're not assuming for 1 minute that it's just female bias. It's also male. So I think from a grassroots perspective, absolutely, you should you should be the mirror of your community.
Yeah.
So not just male and female equality, but also, you know, there's emerging communities, there's people that might provide real cultural diversity to your committee
or just diversity.
So there's a bigger question here, and it's not just about gender, but it's absolutely not, and it's not just a noble cause. It's actually a cause or a strategy, for want of a better word, which will improve membership numbers at your club, engagement, and for the professional clubs like Richmond, and it's fair to say the AFL's been very strong on this, and St Kilda have appointed a female coach. I think North Melbourne have been strong with women in their leadership ranks, and they've got the women's AFL league is going from absolute strength to strength. So they've been really, really strong in this, and gathering momentum, and that's proof, you know, that doing this, not just at the professional level, but also at grassroots level, is going to provide an enormous amount of benefits. That being said, it's how you go about doing this that you know is the real challenge for grassroots sports. You wouldn't, as a club, just go out there to your body of membership and say, "Look, we haven't got enough men on the committee. We need more men." I mean, there's ways that you would approach it, and it would be a very, very good thing to do.
Well, I think, I mean, it's good to get it away from a discussion about women, and we'll continue that point about men in netball, Joe, because I'm a man of netball. My wife's very heavily involved, and Taylor, my 20-year-old daughter's been involved for, seems like 20 years of her life, about 15 years, I guess. So I have been a netball husband and father standing on the side of the courts, and with many other husbands and fathers, and we get together and we socialise, but have been asked to contribute very little over those last 15 years, and on the other side of the coin, Joe, we didn't think to volunteer either. So I just look at the groups of men that I have been shared the side of the court with over the last 15 years, and look at the tremendous opportunity lost to the sport.
Mm.
And now, I mean, having been a cricketer and football in my own right, then flip that conversation, that analogy, over to the ladies that have been on the side, the mothers and the wives and the partners and the sisters and the girlfriends of the players of the clubs I've been involved with for cricket and football. And, you know, traditionally we don't ask them anything, and I know this is going to sound terrible, but except to work in the canteen.
Mm.
You know, but look at the opportunity lost. And that's where we're coming from. Look at the opportunity lost by not engaging with all the groups that are involved in your club and all your community, whether it be on a gender, whether it be on a race, whether it be on an age, Joe. Like, the bowls community traditionally is, the average bowler is 62, I think. So,
You wrote a great article on this piece, and you talked about leadership and its role. Yeah, I've touched on the strategy for executing this before and how that could be a challenge, but it requires leadership, doesn't it?
Well,
to change the culture.
At grassroots
club level.
Well, it requires a decision. Someone's got to raise the topic, and then someone's got to make a decision that the status quo needs to change. And that's the role of the leaders, I think. And so, but again, I want to be very, very clear, and is that for us, and for many people this is a gender discussion, but for us it's about, we're all about our clubs achieving their objectives and being sustainable within their communities and engaging all parts of your communities in all parts of your job, Joe. Oh, sorry, in all parts of your club, has got to be much better off for the club and its long-term sustainability. So that's the news that I saw as being really important. You know that I like to work Richmond into the news as wherever I can, Joe, because they're my passion. But I'm also very proud that they're taking a very strong leadership role. And I guess what? I reckon we're going to try and get Peggy O'Neill the Richmond president onto the show over coming weeks to talk about this, because it's a very, very big topic for us at the moment.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Jonah Vella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au, and there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review so you can help spread the news about Sports Community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs. Okay, welcome back. As mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a very, very special guest with us today. His name is Stuart Bell. He's a partner in Sports Prize Promotions. Welcome to the show, Stuart.
Thank you, Joe.
Stuart, Stephen, thank you for coming into the studio. We're rarely honoured by guests actually making the journey down to Pean Highway to come and visit us at RPPFM in Mornington. So thank you for coming down the road and visiting us in the studio.
That's a pleasure.
Now, Sports Prize. Tell us about Sports Prize, and it's an insurance company, so it's got an insurance element, but bear with us because we're going to link it to fundraising.
Thank you, Steve. Sports Prize is a risk indemnity agency. In other words, we act for a number of clients to produce prize indemnity insurance. It's a bit like an insurance cover.
And so just to put it into the local grassroots sporting context, what you do is for things like golf hole in one competitions and half court basketball shots and goal kicking and those sorts of competitions that we've all seen, nearest the pin, or not nearest the pin, but you indemnify the prize, so it makes it more affordable for grassroots sports clubs.
Yes, that's correct. The hole-in-one is probably the easiest example to use, whereby a player, even in corporate situations where about 100 players could tee off and have the chance to win perhaps a car or a similar prize, which is covered by an insurance policy. And the same can be applied, same principles are applied to other sports. In fact, you can apply it to virtually any sport.
All right. So this is opening up a whole new world to grassroots sports, really, this sort of insurance, because let's just take the hole in one competition. Like, we've all seen the major sporting competitions, major sporting golf tournaments where they have a par three and they've got the car as the prize.
Yes.
Are you saying that most of those tournaments the car would actually be insured against? The tournament would be insuring against someone getting the hole in one?
Yes, absolutely. In almost all cases, I would suggest it would be. The premium is fairly reasonable compared to, obviously, the cost of a car. So why not take that option? And the premiums from a sporting club perspective are almost always paid by the sponsor, being, in this case, the car, a car dealer. You can run up to any prize can be run from $5,000 up to $1 million, depending on how many people and degree of difficulty, which is worked out by the insurance underwriters.
Okay, so we'll keep going with the golf hole-in-one concept, but the concept, as you said, Stuart, when we were talking at the cafe beforehand, was it can really be applied to lots and lots of sports, but what it allows clubs to do is now to offer $1 million prizes or cars as prizes, because they wouldn't normally be able to afford that, and the participants then pay an entry fee, which may or may not be required to cover the insurance. So you don't need to cover the prize, just the cover the insurance costs. So let's say, and the way you were describing it to me over coffee was, say, a corporate golf day where there might be four par threes on the golf course. The first three par threes, you're selecting the people that would be having a shootout on the last par three for the $1 million prize, for instance. So
yes, that's right. The underwriters insist on par three holes. I mean, you could have par two, but as long as the distance is usually around about 150 to 160 metres,
yeah,
that's acceptable to the underwriters. Obviously, the shorter the distance, the higher the premium.
Yep, that makes sense.
And the more players you have who can win the actual prize, again, the premium would increase or fluctuate according to the numbers.
So just to just give us a ballpark, and obviously every situation's different depending on the, well, depending on the risk. It's kind of like two insurance people talking to each other, Joe, the time of my life, which I try to forget working in financial services and insurance. But obviously, the less... That's why you narrow it down from a whole field of 140 in a corporate golf day down to say 20 in that final shootout, just to reduce the risk. And if you do that, what would be the average premium for that sort of day?
It's a good question.
For a $1 million prize, let's go with the $1 million prize, and then we'll go, and then we'll dial it back down to say a car.
That's right, because the $1 million prizes are different to the $50,000 prizes. So corporate days, we'll go to the corporate day second. So the $1 million hole in one, you would need to normally narrow it back to a field, a lower field of, say 50 to 100 people maximum. You would normally have much less than that, depending on how much premium you wish to pay. As an example, there is an event coming up next year in 2015, a local event at Sages. I might give it a plug if that's all right.
Yeah, by all means.
November 2015. $1 million prize, 350 participants narrowed down to 20 finalists. Now, it's the 20 finalists who can win the $1 million.
Hmm.
Along that journey, though, a lot of others who get closer to the pin or even in the pin still win fairly major prizes.
Yep.
So in this case, $1 million, 20 amateur players
yep.
can win the final prize, which is $1 million.
And to give roughly a ballpark, don't necessarily link it back to that competition, but roughly what are we looking at from a premium point of view?
The premium on that in particular is about $6,000.
Yeah, and that's really, when you think about what you can do with that and the sort of event that you can create around that, around that activity and the number of people that you can involve in the qualifying side of it, it's really an achievable way of creating an event that can raise a lot of money for your club, but also create a huge amount of awareness. Now, just going back to that again, we were talking about the Sages Cottage event, and for our yep. National and international listeners, Sages Cottage is a farm owned by a charity on the Mornington Peninsula, and it's a big farm. So it's not just a hole-in-one tournament that you're going to run around that. You're creating a whole event around that day. So take us through how you're doing that.
Right. Well, the first difficulty, Steve, is that it's a non-golf course precinct, so that means that you have to have certain conditions to be able to play on for the underwriters to accept it, and we're fulfilling those obligations. So you have to have the tee off and the green area similar to a golf course. So, and it depends what sort of sport you want to have. If it's off the actual rink, or it's off the half, if it's off a basketball court, or if it's not on a tennis court, for instance, you would have to apply for special conditions with the underwriters in those
yep.
cases.
Yeah.
But everything's achievable, and most underwriters, if a reasonable argument is put to them, that they would accept it. You may need loss adjusters on the day to oversee the event, make sure that everything's done properly
yep.
With independent judges. Normally have two independent judges there on the day, and it's videoed depending on the amount of the prize money. Anything over $50,000 for a hole-in-one is always videoed.
Always videoed. I'm sure it is, because if you win it, you'd want to repeat it and play it to the day you die, I'd reckon. But going back to the Sages Cottage event, the hole-in-one yes. shootout, for yep. want a better terminology, how's the event, how's the structure of that event working? So you've got the hole-in-one, but you've also got other activities on the day, and how are you going through the selection criteria of a bigger field down to the 20 that can shoot out for it all?
All right, yeah, good question. We've decided not to have just a hole-in-one, because a hole-in-one is not necessarily a great event or a holistic event for attendees. So we're now creating a food and wine fair around that.
Yeah.
So it will be an experience for people to attend. There'll be games, there'll be live music, there'll be up to 50 stall holders. There'll be different competitions. There'll be a chipping competition, which will be insured as well. But the main event, which it's created around, is the $1 million hole-in-one,
yep.
whereby around 300 pre-registered attendees will pay for the privilege of hitting one ball. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Three balls for $100. Now, it may sound a lot, Steve, but in fact, there's a lot of value included in that day. So to make it a total experience for the day, we have celebrities and sports people already saying yes. We've got John Blackman as the MC for the day. So he'll be there a full day, and there'll be a lot of signings going on, especially for the players who make the final 20. So they'll be able to mingle with the celebrities and also enjoy dinners with them, dinner and drinks.
Yeah, absolutely. So the food and wine, was that about creating a more holistic event, or was it about decreasing the odds of someone actually getting the hole-in-one after they participated in some of the the refreshments of the day?
I must say, there will be a beer tent there, Steve. You're quite right.
Yes, I would think that's a good risk management strategy, Joe, and I've seen... well, I know my golf game... Actually, my golf game improves after a couple of drinks.
I was going to say, yeah.
My golf game improves. So that's the golf side of it. But the concept itself can be applied to any sport. And so what are the other examples of sports that have used, you know, this methodology of creating a great prize, insuring it, and then creating events and major fundraising around it?
Yes, well, as I said, I think earlier, you can apply it to a number of events. In fact, really any sporting event, we've specialised, Sports Prize Promotions has specialised in sports. You can apply prize indemnity to other activities, but sports is the area we've focused on. So with tennis, for instance, you can have a shootout from a baseline to a baseline and hit a tennis ball on the full through a 10-centimetre hole. So you can, again, have contestants doing that, and you can win. The same concept applies. You can have a number of people playing in an elimination, narrowing it down to, say, five players to win $5,000. So it's a great fundraising day. You can charge an entry fee for the club. It's a good fundraiser, of course. Like all these activities, they're fundraisers.
Yeah, absolutely. So to go, I mean, we were talking about $1 million being $6,000, but say something where the prize is $5,000, you know, what are we looking at there? Just roughly, like ballpark figures. Probably need to prepare you better for these questions, but that would imply we've prepared ourselves. So
again, it depends upon a few factors, but in this case, I think it's around about $800 or $900.
Yeah,
see, for that sort of prize. It's not a lot of money. As again, as I said earlier, the sponsors would pay for that. So from the club point of view, it doesn't cost them anything for the whole those days. In fact, they make money.
Oh, well, then that would be the point of doing them, is to make money and quite significant money in some regards. Mm. Stuart, we talked hole-in-one a lot, but there's lots of other permutations and combinations. And we were talking before the show about an event that you'd seen run where it was choose the number of balls inside a Lamborghini and win the Lamborghini. So how did that work? And give us a rough, I know you can't quote us, but give us a rough idea of premiums. We're talking two, we're talking four, we're talking 20,000, we're talking 40,000. What are we talking to win a Lamborghini?
It was at a motor show, and a major motor show, and in order to promote the show, they used the attraction of having or people selecting the number of balls inside a Lamborghini, and we didn't know, as the agency, we didn't know the number of balls which are going to be in there that was actually selected by the underwriters. I think 5,000 maximum entries, one entry each, and people could pick the number. If they picked the number, they would have won the Lamborghini, which was about $300,000 car, I think, at the time. Was close enough to it anyway. And the premium on that would, again, don't quote me so much on this, but it was certainly under $3,000.
Wow. 5,000 people at $10 a head's 50 grand, Joe.
Absolutely.
And with a chance to win a Lamborghini, that's pretty cool. Now, the Red Cross had a fundraising day as well, using sport and professional indemnity insurance. So serve a tennis ball through a 100mm bullseye targeted, and they held that at Melbourne Park. So how did that, the lead up to that event work, and I guess where did the money come from, and how did the event hold together at the end?
We directly approached the Australian Red Cross, and they liked the idea for the promotion. We had to get the permission to go into Melbourne Park at the time. It was around about this time of the Australian Open, or the lead up to it. So there were people mingling around that area anyway. The application forms were sent via slow mail or snail mail in those days to people prior to the internet, so it was not done online. However, we had, I think, well over 1,000 participants come into there, but it was, again, it was elimination rounds until people got to a final of 10 people, and they had to shoot a ball through a 100mm target bulleye, bulleye target, which is 10 centimetre. And a tennis ball, I think, is about 8.6 centimetre across, so there's not much tolerance. But no one won it, but that doesn't matter because it was some fantastic prizes, tennis rackets and other prizes given away on the day, especially to the finalists.
And people had fun, and that's what it's about.
It was
about.
A great experience, yeah, absolutely.
Now, just moving away from the physical side, the physical challenge side of it, and we've just finished the Melbourne Cup season, and Joe, I know your wallet's a little bit lighter on. My two-year-old did all right out of the sports community sweepstake or whatever it was, but you were talking about how you can link these sorts of concepts and apply them to, say, horse racing.
Yes, we've approached a local Mornington Peninsula a race course. You can probably mm-hmm. think who it might be.
Mm.
And they're linked up with the Caulfield Race Course.
Yeah, Melbourne Racing Club, yeah.
And they're interested in staging for private functions, having a competition whereby if you pick the 5 out of 8 winners on the day, that you would win a major prize. So it can be insured again on that basis. So it's in those situations, it would be a private function rather than an on-course activity.
Yeah,
it would be restricted to those people within the clubhouse.
But even then, if we apply that back to what we know happened in hundreds, at least hundreds, and probably thousands of clubs around the country over the Melbourne Cup Carnival, there was Melbourne Cup events. And
yes.
The traditional Melbourne Cup event is the Calcutta, yes. which has a limited prize pool. But you know, to run a for your attendees, they might throw in some, or they would throw in some money to go into a. What was the prize? Were you thinking of for that sort of magnitude? $20,000, $1 million, or
for the racehorse?
Yeah, pick the 5 winners out of race card.
We actually haven't finalised that, but we're thinking around probably $10,000 rather than a larger amount.
Yeah, and so from that perspective, what would that cost to, you know, give or take with from a premium point of view?
With 100 people able to participate, it's around about $1,400 for 10,000 dollars prize money.
Yeah.
So the premium is only $1,400. Again, it could be paid for by a car dealer or you could even have a flight centre, or I'm promoting the flight centre, aren't I? But you could have a travel agent contributing, and you might win a prize overseas to a major race course, for instance.
Yeah, but even if there wasn't, and it was just $25 entry, I mean, you're really making $10 a head.
That's right.
$10 a head on 100 people is just $1,000.
That's right.
Really for straight in the skyrocket.
And I should point out too, if I could, a lot of our events are charity-based. So we, in most cases, we attempt to have a charity involved on the day. Where it's a club, for instance, obviously the club wants to gain some income from that, but in many cases we like to have a charity involved where they receive a proportion and they help to run the event as well, so with their volunteers.
And that would certainly be relevant for clubs that are looking to create that bigger, broader event where they may not have, A, the audience that can attract, like what you're doing at Sages Cottage, or B, the manpower or the labour force or the volunteers to actually run the event in its totality. So
that's right.
Being able to link in with other community groups is a great concept.
It is, and I think it gives a corporate good feel about it as well, with the sponsors like that, because it's giving money back to the community in many cases. There's some feedback. In the case of Sages, there is actually two charities involved on that day, so they'll both benefit from that event.
Stuart, now I can just hear the minds out there clicking over. With,
I thought that was just yours. I can hear you.
with this great information that Steve's been able to put forward through the agency of yourself. I just want to clarify something. There would have to be a significant skill level required before you would take out this kind of risk. Is that correct?
Not quite correct. The basis of it is it has to be predominantly skill, a game of skill or skill-based.
Yep.
Now, predominantly, I don't think it's been tested, but it would. I believe it, as long as it's 50% or more,
yep,
that would satisfy.
Okay.
So there are some. There could possibly be some legal requirements in some states. So if it's in Australia, for instance, you should check. I know overseas there are some restrictions. On some other countries, there aren't restrictions. Surprisingly, the USA has, in some states, fairly severe restrictions on these sort of activities, but others don't. So
yeah,
you need to check your local authorities.
And would the premium change depending on the level of skill required to get the prize?
No, not necessarily. If it, there is a difference between professional and amateur.
So right.
You need to distinguish between that. You can have professionals playing, but of course your premium substantially increases.
Okay.
In most cases, we only like to have amateurs playing where we can. So in most clubs we deal with only have amateurs, but not all of them.
So for those people out there who are thinking they're going to set up a some kind of competition where they throw a small ball in a big bin and collect the prize because their relative has gone out there and done it, and it's okay because the insurance company will pay for it. Doesn't quite work like that, right?
No, not quite. No, it has to be... It has to be adjudicated, and it has to have loss assessors in some cases, and certainly the bona fides have to be checked. There has to be terms and conditions which the underwriter has to accept. In fact, we create the terms and conditions as well and put them to the underwriter. So it's not quite as simple as it seems. The underwriters don't actually give you the terms and conditions in many cases.
Yeah. Nevertheless, unbelievable opportunity for sports clubs.
Well, let's have a look and let's run through a couple of different sports and just see their collective minds. And so, Stuart, you'll have to obviously be a significant input here into the different. We'll throw some sports around and look at the events that clubs can create around it, because clubs are always looking for unique ways to earn money that doesn't involve standing over a barbecue, Joe. So the half-court basketball shot, for instance, how have you seen that clubs create events around that? So let's just put that in define it properly. Stand at a group of people, one at a time, stand at the half-court line and shoot at the basket?
Yes. For a goal? It can be a combination of having a number of people having a go. And then obviously if that's the insured part of the competition, Steve, that would be then attract a higher premium. If a basketball club only selects one person at random out of the crowd to have a go, then the premium decreases substantially. So, and that's actually done for NRL, so I'm digressing here.
Yeah, please. Another.
But NRL does that from time to time. They'll pick someone out of the crowd to kick a ball into the back of a ute.
So the premium, I've seen that, yeah.
So the premium is actually substantially reduced by one person only having a kick. But if you have a basketball, half-court basketball, you can have 100 people having a shot, one shot. But if you want to ensure that, the premium would be maybe prohibitive.
Yeah.
You may need to narrow that down to through elimination to get to that, say, five people at the end for the finals.
Yeah.
Where your premium would be substantially less.
So thinking about a basket and just putting my old CEO of the Mornington Peninsula European Football League hat on and kind of thinking how we can create an event out of this.
Yep.
If I'm a basketball association, for instance, you could have competitions leading up almost to earn the right to be that person that gets the shot at the $1 million or the $50 or something. So it can build to the crescendo, which would be grand final day.
Yes.
Potentially. And now that I think about it, I've been to grand finals in the country where they were kicking 40 metres at a water tank, I think, from memory. Yes. And I think the prize wasn't of magnitude that it would require indemnity insurance, but you could have.
Did they have to kick the actual ball into the water tank? Or
yeah, and what they'd done was at the start of the finals, I think it was a newspaper, that it was done in conjunction with the local newspaper. The entries came via the newspaper. Then there was people selected each week at the finals to then keep kicking. And then they had a kickoff on grand final day, which got a lot of attention. And I vividly remember I can't remember the ground, but I vividly remember the people lined up on either side of the 40 metres, I think it was, that they were kicking, and they were two or three deep. It was into the goal line, the goal line, two or three deep, 40 metres either side, and fair to say the crowd was working for the underwriters, I reckon, trying to put them off.
But I assume you had to kick it on the full.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is a difference here. You've got to be careful with it. With a goal, for instance, you don't have to hit it on the full. It can be bounce off a tree and go to the hole, and it's counted as a hole in one.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So there's a bit of a strange mix there.
Yeah.
In this case, with the tank, I would assume you have to hit it immediately. Same as getting to the back of a ute.
Yep, it's got into to the full. The
ute, obviously hit the ute and go into the tray.
Yeah.
So it can't bounce on the ground. And the same with tennis, it can't hit the ground first and go through the hole. So there are a few variations on the theme.
Yep.
But in most cases, it's spelled out, obviously, in the terms and conditions, spelled out really well.
So from Aussie rules, so I guess that concept of someone having a shot at goal or kicking into a vessel of some description is how you would do it in Aussie rules?
You could do it. That would probably be the easiest way, is have a car on at halftime or whatever it might be on the oval, and someone is selected out of the crowd. I think that's probably the easiest way.
Yeah.
But you could have some eliminations to make it more exciting, and then we tend to give away ancillary prizes where we can. So there's all winners rather than losers. People who make the finals, we like to give everyone a prize, so it makes them everyone wins in that case.
Yeah.
If no one wins the major prize, still everyone gets a fairly good prize.
And so I guess just talking specifically about the services offered by Sports Prize, and again, the only reason we've got you talking in here today is because we think the concept of as a fundraiser is outstanding for sports clubs, not because you're here commercially or we have a commercial partnership or anything like that. So that's important for the listeners to know. But part of your services, which I must admit I really like, because you've got the event management side, but also the sponsorship side, which are two things where clubs may genuinely struggle to be able to provide those services for themselves. So take us through the event management side of it and the sponsorship side of it.
Okay. Well, we set up Sports Prize Promotions really to offer a one-stop shop. In other words, we can offer only prize indemnity to clients who ring up and say, can you give us a quote on a hole-in-one? And we do that from time to time. That's fine. And we don't get involved with any other activity. But in some cases, clubs don't have the experience with the event management sponsorship marketing, especially if it's a fairly large event to be able to create. So we would help out with them and charge them an agreed fee along that journey.
Yes.
And that fee would usually come out of the net proceeds at the end. So in many cases, they're not out of pocket at all.
Fantastic. And so from the sponsorship side of it, how does that work? Do you go and get the sponsors for the events?
Yeah, we'll actually go out and attract sponsors on behalf of the club or clubs. We'd work with the clubs because we don't want any conflict of interest. We don't want two competing sponsors in any case. And that may be the situation. We're always aware of that, of competing sponsorships.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But we do actually go out and assist. We've got a number of companies, sporting companies, already coming on board as supporters of Sports Prize Promotion. So they'll be in a situation to either offer product prizes or cash prizes along that journey.
Yeah. I'm just thinking as we go, Joe, it can apply to, I'm assuming, things like archery and, you know, shooting bullseyes and soccer. And really, the more that we've only been talking about it for 25 minutes on air and maybe a little that time again off air, and the mind just starts to think about all the different sports that we work with, Joe, and all the different permutations and combinations that the clubs could create that would create this massive event, like with not that much work, massive media. Like, you could get a lot of media coverage around this because it's something different. You know, not every day something, well, I suppose every week someone can win Tats Lotto, but the odds are a lot better than winning Tats Lotto.
Yes.
And you can do a lot of really good positive things for your club, no matter what the sport.
I just don't think clubs, or that many grassroots clubs, would know about this service.
No, they may not. There's also examples outside sport, and people know the Eddie McGuire.
Yeah, millionaire hot seat.
Well, that's insured.
Yeah, the million and 500,000.
A lot of people would know that's insured.
Yeah,
It's insured for certainly for $1 million. I'm not sure about the lower cash
price. Yeah, 500,000 that's insured for as well, and 250 they're on their own.
So
Channel 9 where there is.
I don't know if anyone's won it in Australia. I don't think they have, but you know, that obviously insurance underwriters rubbing their hands with glee.
And there's a risk assessor there for every single show, making sure that Eddie doesn't give too many hints to Collingwood supporters.
So if I could just walk a case study, potential event day through with you, Stuart, just for, like, I like, football's my go, so soccer. If a soccer club out there was to, for example, get a A-League goalkeeper to come down and they would then have a penalty shootout competition, which the winner might have a chance of winning a car, and you could build an event day around that, couldn't you?
Yes.
Which is amazing. You know, A-League footballer comes down, you got promotion off that, you've got the car, you've got people engaged.
Yes.
That's a fantastic way to raise funds.
It is.
Yeah, Joe, I'd be thinking that all clubs should just... that's all right, Stuart, our phones go off all the time. Joe yells at us, so that's fine. You know, just with 20 minutes of brainstorming, I reckon you could come up with three or four great events that would use your club, the facilities of your local community, or your crowds and organisations to create an event that would be absolutely outstanding.
Well, our audience is always starved of unique fundraising opportunities, and we do our best to try and provide them with that. And this is a real doozy, and your phone's probably going off because there's people hearing it.
Well, that's a very good point, Joe. Now, how, as Sports Prize, so how can clubs get in touch with you, Stuart?
I'll just touch on what Joe said as well, if you don't mind. And I think that...
That's okay. You do it because Steve never
does. Yeah, really, it doesn't. It's not worthy of it. We just go over. Sorry, Joe, that's unfair.
Is that you could run a series of events over a period of time, Joe. You could have it, as Steve suggested, you could have a grand final on grand final day or whatever the soccer grand final day is.
Well,
that's in summer, isn't it, I think? But you could run a series of events leading up to that and have elimination rounds. Create excitement along that journey. So you can do a mix and match all the way through. You can change the variations and even change the rules if you want to, as long as the underwriter agrees.
Yep.
And different variations, and just mix it up. But at the end of the day, you want to make sure that people have an experience on that day. That's the whole...
Yeah.
And have a great day, in other words, of doing it.
Or even along the journey. So you can get... You know, there could be open up to 1,000 people to start with, and you have the elimination rounds in whatever theme, and then you get down to that core group, which is it's that core group that you're bearing the risk on, not that's the 1,000.
Right. But if you want 1,000 people, you need to have other activities there on the day.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I think, either that or you tie it into a club event day. So one of the great things about this is if you tie it in with registration day, for example, you've all of a sudden created the opportunity for your club to attract a whole bunch of new potential members to the club by being there, attracted to the prize and the day. And it's a win-win on all levels, you know. Mm. Registration, maybe attract new members.
Social members.
Yeah. You know, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail right on the head. We like it to be a win-win.
That's twice now I've hit the nail right on the head. Yep.
We like it to be a win-win.
It's only taken 35 shows, Joe, so we're going beautifully.
It's good that you understand quality, Stuart.
Now I know that...
So how do they contact us?
Because our other Stuart, the producer who pulls our show together, Joe, is going about now going, get off the air, boys. So how do we get in touch with you, Stuart?
Well, we have a website, which is pretty easy to remember, sportsprize.com.au.
Yeah.
Or if you want to email us, info@sportsprize.com.au, or even myself, Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, @sportsprize.com.au. That's probably the easiest way initially to make contact with us rather than give a phone number.
Well, I would suggest that is completely right. Go to the website. Stuart Bell, founder of Sports Prize, thank you very much for coming on the Sports Community Show and sharing what is unique. It has been around for a long time, but we're only just starting to get our minds around this the potential of this this huge fundraising concept for even the smallest of clubs, Joe. I reckon time well spent, and we thank you very much for coming down to Peen Highway.
Thank you, gentlemen.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts Jonah Vella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au. And there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review. so you can help spread the news about sports community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs. Okay, we've come to the end of the show here on RPPFM, the Sports Community Radio Show. We hope you've enjoyed the discussions that we've had today around grassroots sport and the views of our special guest, Stuart Bell of Sports Prize Promotions. Once again, thanks to RPPFM for hosting us, the voice of the peninsula, and on behalf of myself, Joe Novella.
And me, Steve Pallas, thank you for making us part of your sports community.